Good morning and welcome to Storylines on the Bay 88.7 FM. I'm your host, Christine Cowley, and today we're speaking with Antanas Salika, author, journalist, book critic. Many listeners will recognize Antanas's name from his many years as director of Humber School for Writers in Toronto. Welcome, Antanas.
Thanks a lot.
And I could have gone on and on with that introduction because of all the things that you've done and the ways in which people will recognize you. But today we're really speaking about your most recent title, The Barefoot Bingo Caller, which is your fifth book. And interestingly, you've written these five books while working full-time as a teacher and then director at Humber School for Writers. So you've been a really busy guy.
I've been a busy guy, but it's been a lot of fun. I've got to say that in addition to, you know, running the writing school, of course, I had a family and two young boys, and I freelanced as well. So it was busy, but it was fun.
Barefoot Bingo Caller, we've talked off air about how laugh out loud funny it was for me because of so much recognition. We actually grew up in the same area of Toronto, and I loved everything that you hearken back to because at the time it was so full of angst, and you've just made it so funny in retrospect. But what was interesting for me was that in the afterword, you say that you resisted writing a memoir because you'd rather be writing novels. And now that you've committed your stories to paper, you'll probably be accused of writing fiction. So I wonder, is that kind of the lot of the memoirist?
Well, I think it's completely, you lose in a way on both sides, because I dealt with some of this material in the book 20 years ago called Buying on Time, and people would say things like, you just wrote down your life, this isn't a story at all. And of course, and now that I've done the reverse, that I've written a memoir, I have certain types of accusations saying, well, you just made most of this up. And of course, everybody has a different point of view about the time. My eldest brother, who read this book and who appears in the book, said to me, I'm going to write a book too, and I'm going to call it Truth. But I'll tell you, there's another difference, is that in memoir, I say that in writing other things, in writing fiction, in effect, you're getting undressed behind the screen. And when you're writing memoir, you're stepping out in front of the screen. And I normally work in fiction. So here I was, and there were a couple of those adult kind of moments. And you imagine yourself standing around at age 12 with your hockey buddies, and you're talking about the girlfriend who became your wife, and part of me, the western part of me, where I grew up, was, oh, man, are you sure you want to reveal this?
Mm.
And the adult says, well, of course, you must reveal. That's what's interesting to people.
So was it difficult to make a decision on which stories you were going to tell and which you were just leaving on the cutting room floor?
Well, because there are two different types of memoir. One is a memoir of a famous person, right? So if you get somebody, one of the Clintons, everybody's going to rush out to find out what it's all about.
Sure.
Because I'm not famous, the memoir has to bring some sort of value to the reader. In other words, it's got to be interesting. There is that job that has to be done to interest the reader, to illuminate the thing, to make them laugh, or sometimes to make them cry. So there has to be, it's not everything in my life. One of the rules of novels is they're like life with the boring parts left out.
Yes.
Only with the memoir, right? It's my life with the boring parts left out. But I have to say I had help with this too. By nature, and I mentioned it in the afterword, a bit of a talker, especially after alcohol or coffee, they both have the same effect. And away I go, just this side of being a blowhard, I hope, trying to amuse. So what'll happen is that even after all these decades, I'm married almost 40 years, my wife will say, she'll point to me and go, write that. And I'm usually barely aware that these things strike some kind of chord. And in this case, my wife and my publisher, when we were sitting around having drinks, and I was beginning to talk, and he said to me, you've got to write this, stop talking, write it down. And my wife heard, and then when we got home, she said, okay, go upstairs and be funny now.
Well, you have no problem. It seems to me it's effortless for you to make us laugh, but you make us laugh and then there's the sting. There's always the sting. One of the things that you bring forward is this idea that there is always a much more exciting life in the U.S. and in Canada. We don't get to do anything. There's too many rules.
Well, yes, too many rules. And compounded in so many different ways. So that, one, Canada felt boring compared to the United States in my childhood. You know, all of the TV channels came out of the USA, out of Buffalo. And they advertise things like Three Musketeers, which seemed so wonderful. It's a simple chocolate bar, but it seemed so wonderful. And they had Superman, and we had Pearson as the Prime Minister. Superman. The second thing is I lived in Weston, which was on the edge of Toronto, which was a small town being swallowed and turned into a suburb. But again, you felt like you're out of it there. You felt like you're nowhere near any important metropolis. And then thirdly, because you're immigrant from an immigrant family, I keenly felt, like a lot of immigrant kids do, wanting to fit in, I keenly felt that we were out of it. So out of it on three different levels. And it's kind of funny because you're scrambling, trying to be, well, it was hopeless, but at least, you know, not completely ridiculous.
Yeah, but you managed to escape that, you know, small town, really, because even though you were part of Toronto, as you say, at the time you were growing up in Weston, it was really just out in the sticks. And I know that because I lived next door to Weston and Downsview. But you made it all the way to Paris, except you here's the sting part, which is what I love so much about your humor. You didn't go to Paris because you longed to be, you know, the young artist in Paris and make your mark on the world. You went to Paris to follow a girl, to make sure she didn't marry anybody else. I love this.
You know, that was my greatest. I wasn't even intending to go to Paris. I was intending to, as a young man, save some money. And I was going to, and I was lousy in languages, so I was going to go to Australia. I mean, it's the furthest place that I could figure out where they speak English. Now, New Zealand's another possibility. But, you know, this girl was fantastic. And I started to see her a bit in Toronto. She was going to Paris, so what could I do? I had to follow the girl. I mean, and so there I end up in Paris, unintentionally, but it worked out pretty well.
It worked out very well in both ways because, of course, the girl became your wife of 40 years. You've mentioned Snaiga. And also, as you've mentioned, very much a co-creator with a lot of your work.
Yes, very much so. It was kind of interesting for me to get her commentary. I mean, for better or for worse. I mean, she once looked up from a page of my writing and said to me, "Is this supposed to be funny?"
Oh.
It's like a knife to the heart. But then in return, she'll bring up her artwork. She's got a big show coming up in Europe next year. So I was down in the basement looking at something. I said, "Wow, that's fantastic. When did you do that?" She said, "Well, I wasn't going to show it to you because I'm in the creative process. I was afraid of what you might say." So we do an exchange back and forth for better or worse. But we're kind of used to each other now, showing each other material. She, her artwork, and my writing.
Yes.
Pretty well.
Now in Paris, you fell into this group of expats who, I guess you were an editorial collective, and you were producing a literary journal called Paris Voices, which of course, in retrospect, looks terribly exciting. But at the time, you were all just sitting around critiquing each other's work, which didn't at the time seem that exciting.
No, it didn't seem that exciting at the time at all. It just seemed like we're trying to figure things out. But, you know, a lot of the writers in various places trying to figure things out, in retrospect, it looks, suddenly you see how things are formative. And I've got a kind of a funny story that happened around that just recently. One of the editors there was a guy named Ken Timmerman, who went on to become a super right-wing Republican Trump supporter in the USA, whose permission I never asked. Up about 4 weeks ago, out of the blue.
Wow.
And I had this moment at the dinner table where I was figuring out, was he angry? And after one bottle of wine, we figured out we didn't know he was there. After a second bottle of wine, we started to feel close to one another. The third bottle of wine, I confessed to him that he was there, and then he read it and he forgave.
Good story. Good ending to the story. Now, one of the other things that you kind of again fell into was as an interpreter when Lithuania was making its exit from the Soviet Union in the late 80s and 90s. Tell us about that experience.
Well, it was such an unlikely thing that I resented as a child, as many immigrant kids had to go to the various Saturday schools to learn the language and history of where their people came from. And, you know, we had to miss cartoons. It was like this arcane information of a language that you imagine no one would ever be interested in.
Mm-hmm.
Strangely, of the world, as the world begins to change, dramatically, Lithuania becomes important to the collapse of the old Soviet Union. And suddenly, I'm getting calls. Information I have becomes important. And, strangely, I get a call from Ottawa when the Lithuanian president is coming for a meeting with our prime minister and our minister of external affairs, in other words, Mulroney and Clark. They need an interpreter and ask me. I'm not even trained as an interpreter. You know, I mean, I know the language pretty well. I spoke with my parents. But really, they're going to be discussing politics and economics. There I am having to do this interpretation. I'm sweating bullets because it's beyond my capabilities. But even there, something funny happened.
Actually, you have some great insights to what was going on, and you became this handler of people who you respected and admired. And one of the things that you describe as this first generation Canadian who had to take Lithuanian classes, and of course you desperately wanted to fit in, but you were also, as most of us were, loath to defy your parents' demands that you preserve your roots. So after a few failures, you find your footing as an ethnic dancer. So we're going to hear an excerpt. We're going to leave for a short break. And when we come back, we're going to have you read a small excerpt about being a Lithuanian ethnic dancer. Listeners, stay with us. You're listening to Storylines on 88.7 FM. We'll be right back with Antanas Salika. Welcome back to Storylines on the Bay 88.7 FM. I'm your host, Christine Cowley, and our guest today is journalist, author, book critic, and former director of the Humber School for Writers, Antanas Salika. Antanas, before the break, I promised our listeners they would actually capture some flavor of this wonderful memoir you've given us, The Barefoot Bingo Caller. So give us a setup to the excerpt you're going to be reading.
Okay, so this section is set in 1970. It's called The Beer Barrel Polka, and it's about parents trying to keep their kids really connected to the ethnic community as the kids try to escape. And it goes like this. My father was puffing on his pipe by the garage when I walked up Langside Avenue and turned into the driveway at number 22. He was skulking, I thought, and he beckoned me over. Your mother tells me she found a Bay Street bus transfer in your pants pocket. Been going downtown? My father's question sounded innocent enough, but he was crafty, and I had to watch my step. Bay Street was close to Yorkville, and an admission to visiting Yorkville would have been the end of me. Yeah, I said. I wanted to go to the Hercules store to look at some knapsacks. Hercules is right on Yonge, my father said. Why did you take the Bay bus? My father always traveled by car, and he had the worst sense of direction of anyone I knew. Yet somehow, the bus routes were clear in his head. Must have looked them up. I had to tread very carefully. It was a nice day, I said. I wanted to stay above ground, so I took the Bay Street bus instead. My father nodded, but he was still suspicious. How could he have known about Hercules in the first place? He hated downtown. We lived in a suburb of Weston. My father never went anywhere except to the Lithuanian church and to work. The summer of love, 1967, was only 3 years behind us, and people in Toronto were still wearing tie-dyed T-shirts and granny glasses. Love was in the air, supposedly, but not enough of it had made it across the border from the States, as far as I was concerned. Not only was Canada boring, but Eastern European parents had built their own iron curtain to keep the kids imprisoned in old-fashioned attitudes. The TV channels that came across the airwaves from Buffalo were our own voice of America that underscored the tyranny of our parents. Go inside, my father said. Your mother has something she wants to tell you. My mother was mixing a cake. She was always mixing a cake. She made poppy seed cake that left black dots between your teeth for days. You could clean them out with a toothpick, and a day later, new one would rise to the surface between your teeth, a fossil of yesterday's meal. She also made dense yellow pound cake, an upside-down apple cinnamon cake. The characteristic that all these cakes shared was their dryness. the advantage of this was that they could stand on a table indefinitely. They were made to eat with coffee. And if ever a war came and there was a coffee shortage, the cakes could sit on the table and wait a few years until the war ended, rationing ended, and coffee became available again. I wanted Betty Crocker, but my mother would never make anything out of a mix, and my father wouldn't eat a frosted cake. When I got inside, she gave me the mixing bowl with 2 cups of sugar and a cup of hard butter fresh out of the fridge. I had to mix it for her as she stood by the kitchen sink and separated egg whites from their yolks. The butter wasn't even cut up into pieces. The block kept threatening to shoot out of the bowl like a loose hockey puck. "I'm worried about you," my mother said. She was dressed in a green pantsuit, pretty fancy for a Saturday with no company. But look at her, you'd almost think she was a real Canadian, unlike my father, who might as well have had the letter I for immigrant stamped on his forehead. My mother looked modern. She even listened to Herb Alpert, but she still thought like all the other immigrant mothers down at the parish hall. After 25 years in the country, she had learned about camouflage. "I called Mrs. Aldona," my mother said, "and she's agreed to take you on, even though you don't have any experience." Uh-oh, they were taking action. All because of that crummy bus transfer in my pocket. One tiny slip, and I was doomed. "Doing what?" I asked. "Folk dancing. She runs the Lithuanian Sea Scout Folk Dance Ensemble." It was important not to laugh. Like gods, my parents seemed to be able to see deeply into my heart. And like gods, their actions were unpredictable. They crushed me for their sport. I don't even belong to the Boy Scouts anymore," I said. "She's willing to overlook that. You rejoin. I've already bought a uniform shirt and a hat." I looked through the doorway into the dining room, and there on the table lay the shirt in a new cellophane package and the old-fashioned sailor's hat that looked as if it had come straight sailor. No amount of sighing did any good. Why didn't I just refuse? It was tough being a good boy. Good boys suffered more than most. I guess I didn't want to upset them. But my own goodness was killing me. And that's the end.
It was just a wonderful excerpt to read, because in this excerpt we get all of that angst and the wanting to please. And really, that is so much growing up in the 50s and 60s, is we still wanted to please our parents.
Oh, my God. It certainly doesn't seem to be the case today, but never mind.
One of the comments that you make in the afterword, I want to touch on this before we need to wrap. You've said that towards the latter part of the book, you get a bit melancholy. And I understand what you were describing, but I'm wondering if these reflections toward the end are more about maturity and recognition that, okay, maybe we didn't set the world on fire as we had hoped we would as artists, but something in our lives, something in reclaiming the truths we discovered, or just everyday hardships that we overcame, and then, you know, having to work for a living instead of doing our art and becoming famous. Is it just maturity rather than melancholy?
Part of the realization later in life is that things don't work out quite as you planned them, quite as you thought they would earlier on in your life. The children take their own turns. Things play out in a different way. That's okay in the end, too, because that's the way life has to play. It has to play out its own way, not according to your plan.
Words of wisdom there for sure. Now, of course, as your role as director of Humber School for Writers for many, many years, you've counseled thousands of would-be artists and would-be writers. Are there a few nuggets of wisdom for would-be writers?
Words that I say most often is that writing is most frequently a marathon, not a sprint. I have a novel coming out in a couple of years. It took 10 rewrites. It's a long, long time. If you write the novel, sometimes it takes a long time to get noticed. Sometimes you have to throw it out and start again. So what you need then is the ability to get into the long marathon that's coming up. So you get depressed because it happens to everybody. You get depressed, and then you've got to rise up and go again. You've got to keep on going and keep on going, not to give up, not to give up. That's the hardest part.
Excellent advice, and you couldn't have said it better. And Tanis, we've got to wrap up today. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Tell us how we can, before we go, can you tell our listeners where they can purchase the Barefoot Bingo Collar and where they can find out more about your upcoming readings? I understand you're in Collingwood tomorrow.
Yes, I am in Collingwood tomorrow. There's a new bookstore opening up there. The readings, geez, the season is pretty much wrapped up. There's not much happening after Collingwood. But the book, you probably have to order it if you're going to a bookstore. But then all the online options are there. That comes in. I tend to buy most of my books online unless I happen to be around the bookstore. So, you know, whether it be Amazon or Indigo or one of those online services, it's freely available that way. Or let them know at your bookstore that you want it. They can get it in.
And they can certainly go to your website. Why don't you give us that URL?
Yes, my website is just simply my first and last name, together.ca. So antanassileika.ca, spelled AntanassSileika.ca.
Perfect. Antanas, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you this morning.
It's been a real pleasure, a delight. Thanks a lot.
Listeners, thank you so much for tuning in this morning to Storylines on the Bay, 88.7 FM. I'm your host, Christine Cowley. And remember, we are here in two new time slots, Saturday mornings at 8:05 a.m. and Wednesday nights at 11 p.m. And we will keep on talking to authors and book folks about books and the writing life. Thank you for joining us. Please join us again.